I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway. It's good to be here, so let's talk.
We stand, in my view, at an inflection point in history.
On Tuesday, in his first speech to the United Nations General Assembly as U.S. President, President Joe Biden declared a new era for U.S. diplomacy.
And I'm here today to share with you how the United States intends to work with partners and allies to answer these questions, and the commitment of my new administration to help lead the world toward a more peaceful, prosperous future.
President Biden repeatedly sought to reassure U.S. allies that his presidency would not echo the chaos of Trump's 4 years in office.
We've ended 20 years of conflict in Afghanistan. And as we close this period of relentless war, we're opening a new era of relentless diplomacy.
But even as the president was promising relentless diplomacy, his administration was scrambling to repair a breach in the centuries-long relationship with our oldest ally. Late last week, relations between the U.S. and France soured over a submarine deal gone bad that led France to recall its diplomats from the U.S. for the first time in American history. On Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki addressed the tension.
The president during this call acknowledged that there could be more discussion in advance of the announcement, and that was an important message for him to convey during that conversation.
At the UN, President Biden promised a new era
of using the power of our development aid to invest in new ways of lifting people up around the world, of renewing and defending democracy.
Powerful words, but delivered even as the healthcare system in Afghanistan collapses, buckling under the strain that the hasty American withdrawal has inflicted in recent weeks. The president's words paint a picture of compassionate strength, an image discordant with the brutal inhumanity visible at the U.S.-Mexico border. Here's U.S. Border Chief Raul Ortiz earlier this week.
We are working around the clock to expeditiously move migrants out of the heat elements and from underneath this bridge to our processing facilities in order to quickly process and remove individuals from the United States consistent with our laws and our policies.
After 4 years of seemingly directionless foreign policy during the Trump years, just how much of a departure is the Biden era? We're joined now by
Robin Wright, The New Yorker, and distinguished fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C.
And
Daniel Dresner, professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University.
Dan, I'm going to start with you. Let's talk a little bit about President Biden's speech at the UN this week. What did you hear?
What I heard was Biden trying to articulate the sort of grand strategy that he's been articulating since he first became president, which is that the United States needs to slough off the distracting threats to focus on the truly existential threats. And this was at the basis of why the Biden administration pursued the withdrawal from Afghanistan and why, among other things, they reached that submarine deal earlier this month with Australia and the United Kingdom, which is Biden was very clear in the address in saying that he thinks the biggest threats facing the United States, first of all, don't necessarily come from other countries out there. They're what we would say non-agentic. So we're talking here about the pandemic, we're talking about climate change, and those are the things that I think truly energize him. And to the extent that states are a threat out there, the ones that he's concerned about are primarily China and Russia. And therefore, from Biden's perspective, getting embroiled in Afghanistan does not advance U.S. interests anywhere else. And so he articulated the idea that we need to combat these threats, and he talked a lot about multilateral cooperation along the way, which is certainly something you would have not heard from his predecessor.
Yep. All right. So, Robin, on that topic, talk to me a little bit about this notion of international cooperation in the context of the speech that the president was giving, because that record on international cooperation has come under fire a bit lately.
Biden came to the United Nations at a time of vulnerability for the United States. Biden made the difficult decision to pull the last U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, which was a unilateral decision when it came to the timing. Many of our allies also involved in the NATO force in Afghanistan were given little or no notice, and they had to scramble as well to pull out their own forces, their own personnel, and their own Afghan people. Then it was followed by this rather clumsy rift with France, where Britain, the United States, and Australia tried to announce a big nuclear sale of submarines, and without notifying France, which had for 5 years its own deal to sell more conventional submarines to Australia. And this has led to a rift with the United States' longest ally, a very serious rift. The French recalled their ambassador in Washington and initially refused to meet with Biden. While Macron and Biden have had a conversation, the French say this is still a crisis and we have a lot to iron out before we go back to where we were. This is something that's never happened before. So whether it's America's longest ally or America's longest war, the Biden administration has not done very well. The president focused on multilateralism in trying to tackle the challenges of the 21st century. The problem was he, as the most experienced president in American history on foreign policy, came in with a credibility problem on foreign policy.
It's not as though the president is the sole actor in our nation's foreign policy. There is a State Department, and I'm wondering a bit about the state of the State Department after 4 years of the Trump administration. It's my understanding that several critical aspects of our American bureaucracy are functioning at a level that is sort of below what we would typically imagine that it is. And I'm wondering if this is part of what's going on, where somebody sort of forgets to call France about the Australian sub deal.
Well, the State Department witnessed a mass exodus during the Trump administration. Many of his employees felt that they couldn't represent American interests or that policies didn't represent American interests and opted to get out. I think the real problem, though, is closer to the White House, whether it's the National Security Council or the team of foreign policy advisors who regularly get the president ready for big summits like the United Nations in September, In November, you have the big climate conference in Glasgow, you have the G20 in Rome in October, that there are these big summits that Biden really had hoped to be in his honeymoon and just carve out a new agenda to get beyond the Trump years to show that America didn't believe just in America first. And the problem is it looks like that U.S. policy still is America first. So I think Biden faces a rough road ahead of him. You know, it's one thing to talk a good game, and he talked a very good game at the United Nations. The problem is, how do you get beyond the longstanding diversity among allies, but the wider world? How do you bring together our competition in Russia or China? How do you bring together the smaller states who don't believe the United States is doing enough for them? The problem is we too often rely on those who are the autocrats or those who have stabilized their countries by repression rather than by inclusion. And so I think Biden has a rough road ahead.
So if you both want to uphold sort of a value of democracy, but without state building, that's going to be messy. And then I want to return to this point you made, Dan, about non-agentic actors like pandemics that are the great threat, climate change as the great threat. It is much harder to build a wall, forgive me, against a pandemic than, you know, to sort of mobilize subs against a nation state. What kind of foreign policy, what kind of diplomacy does it take to build a messy coalition around something as messy itself as a pandemic?
Well, presumably it takes a multilateral coalition, which is the message that Biden was trying to deliver in his UN General Assembly address. And you would presume that particularly combating a pandemic would be something where, regardless of whether the state is authoritarian or democratic, generally speaking, you don't want to have too many of your citizens die or get sick. So this should be an area where there would be greater cooperation. But the very fact that you've had such a surge of vaccine nationalism, the fact that it's been difficult to get shots in arms outside of the advanced industrialized countries demonstrates that even in this area, there's difficulty in getting all your ducks in a row. And the problem is, and this was the cognitive dissonance in Biden's speech, is that on the one hand, he is fully aware that it is going to be impossible to combat things like pandemics or climate change without significant multilateral buy-in. The problem is that in order to get the U.S. to reorient itself towards those things, it has had to engage in some relatively messy disengagements particularly with respect to Afghanistan. I'm not quite as pessimistic as Robin when it comes to how the Biden administration has handled foreign policy, but it is safe to say that what they've been very bad at is a term that George Shultz, who was Secretary of State, used to describe as gardening, which is taking care of your allies and making sure that they are looped in to prevent frictions and problems from metastasizing before they become really a big problem. And that's an area where this administration has not done terrifically well. And hopefully they will learn their lessons from that and be better at this going forward.
You have to weed your garden and cultivate your soil to get it to grow, kind of thing?
Exactly. That basically taking care of allies, and this is the U.S.'s comparative advantage in the world. We have far more allies than everyone else. China has technically, I think, one treaty ally. Russia doesn't have that much more. A lot of countries want to be allied to the United States, which is great. Part of the reason for that is that we do share common interests. There are a lot of countries concerned about the rise of China. There are a lot of countries concerned about the rise of Russia. But just because they're aligned doesn't mean interests are perfectly in sync. And that's where diplomacy is supposed to manage these minor frictions and prevent them from becoming into something where the French get really upset.
Is climate change or the pandemic, are they zombies, Dan?
Yes, they are, Melissa, and I'm glad you asked me that question. Yeah, so I wrote a small book called Theories of International Politics and Zombies, which tried to explain what different theories of international politics would do if the dead started rising from the grave and feasting upon the living. And one of the things I wrote in that book is that zombies were the perfect 21st century threat because they were protean and very hard to contain. And again, this is something where we're all old enough to remember the 20th century threats, in which it was basically the Soviet Union and or the threats posed by other nation states. And we are now dealing in a world in which the biggest threats don't necessarily come from states, whether we are talking about climate change or pandemics or other sort of Malthusian checks on human flourishing or things like cyber attacks and so forth. And these are threats where states might be good at coping with the domestic implications of them, but trying to coordinate at the international level is a new challenge. And so it requires more diplomacy and it requires more foresight. And that's not something that a lot of governments have had a lot of in this century.
Now, I'm going to play something for the two of you. This is Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas on Fox News earlier this week, responding to the president's speech at the UN.
A lot of the world sees Joe Biden and just laughs at the statements he made yesterday. You just mentioned or played a clip there. It said we don't seek a new Cold War. Well, of course we don't seek a new Cold War. We would rather have peace with all nations. But when China is waging a Cold War against the United States, we don't have a choice whether we're in it or not. We only have a choice to win or to lose.
So, Robin, we've been talking about this new sort of era of threats and new eras of policy making and diplomacy. But what I hear there is sort of perhaps old-fashioned, but also maybe accurate, a description of China as the competitor and a question of whether or not we can win or lose. Does Cotton at least have a point?
Cotton does have a point. I think the problem with China is that it doesn't have to cater to its population, unlike Joe Biden. China has been very uncooperative on some of the big existential questions of our times, most notably climate change. The United States has sent John Kerry to talk to the Chinese several times now. And the Chinese are basically saying, why should we go along with something that's just your agenda? If you want to talk about a broad range of issues that reflect our global agenda, then we can put climate in there as well. And so, you know, without China's cooperation on climate, we have huge obstacles in actually moving forward. I think one of the bigger issues as we pivot to this new era where the attacks are not just by the military or a germ, but they're also by cyber, that the nature of warfare or competition have changed in a digital age where information is a tool that we have to fight for now, that one of the problems is where is the leadership coming from? And during the pandemic, the global momentum has been sapped. The kind of international muscle has atrophied as governments across the world have become consumed with mere survival. And so the challenge is for Joe Biden, not just to achieve his agenda, but to try to mobilize leaders that first and foremost need to ensure that their people survive. And the divide at this moment is greater than it's ever been. When you look at the United States has 55% of its people fully vaccinated, about to go into a third round. And Africa, you have somewhere around 3% of an entire continent of 54 countries vaccinated, that the divide is only going to get deeper with all the repercussions it brings with it, economically, in terms of political dissatisfaction and potential unrest, that we're headed into a period that will have so many broader challenges. I think some of us don't even see or recognize yet. And we're talking about some of these old issues. So, or thinking in terms of the kind of reactive means of, we have to deal with this issue, this issue, this issue, like Afghanistan, but we're not being as creative in kind of dealing with the existential crisis. And next of all, what do we create out of this?
So, Dan, what does one do as a superpower if the other primary big player on the stage, because, you know, this point about the vaccines and this enormous divide, right, that doesn't just mimic but actually grows the global divide, right, around vaccines and wealth and GDP. But on the other hand, with China, or not on the other hand, but at the same time, China is well vaccinated, is moving forward, doesn't have to, you know, cater to the Tom Cottons, or is the Tom Cotton, right? There are these sorts of arguments. How then does the U.S. create this more nimble global action when it seems to sometimes have to be acting alone relative to these other nations?
I think by leading by example, and here I'm going to push back on a few of the premises in your question. The first is, it's not clear to me that, in fact, China is terribly well vaccinated.
That's what they're saying.
Yes, they're saying that, but we know that, in fact, the Chinese vaccines are not nearly as effective, particularly against the Delta variant, as the mRNA vaccines that Pfizer and Moderna have developed. And indeed, the Chinese head of the Chinese CDC basically acknowledged that before that acknowledgement was then scrubbed from the internet. So this is something to bear in mind. China talks a lot about things that are working. The fact that they actually don't work is something to bear in mind. Also, this was something that Biden was relatively artful for in his General Assembly address, where he talked about the idea that the U.S. was going to give vaccines to other countries without conditions. And that was a noted contrast to Russia and China, which have had strings attached in the case of some vaccine deliveries, but also have tried to reward allies as opposed to just the more general population. So I think the way that Biden can deal with this is just simply by making sure that the U.S. is responsible for distributing as many vaccines as possible to the rest of the world. And that's the way in which you eventually start getting life returning to a pre-pandemic normal. And finally, I cannot resist pointing this out. The idea that Senator Tom Cotton was going to argue that the world was laughing at Joe Biden at the UN General Assembly is cruelly ironic, given that the world actually laughed at Donald Trump when he was giving his UN General Assembly address a few years ago. They weren't laughing at Biden. They might be somewhat skeptical about Biden. They might note the hypocrisies of Joe Biden and American foreign policy, but that's normal. Laughing at someone, that's unique to Trump.
That's a useful insight. Robin, let's talk a little bit about the U.S. drone strike that killed 10 civilians in Afghanistan. How does that moment, and then the Biden administration's sort of willingness relatively swiftly to acknowledge that that was an error, does that increase the administration's credibility because it admitted it, or does it reduce their credibility because the mistake happened?
I think it worries a lot of countries, and I think it worries those in Washington as well, that the United States now has to rely on what it calls over-the-horizon offense when it comes to jihadi threats, whether it's ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or any of the jihadi groups that now have proliferated around the world. That drone strike killed 10 civilians, including 7 children, and the United States still had troops there. It was not carried out by those troops, but it was by a drone, and we were wrong. Our intelligence was wrong. And this is, I think, one of the things that's going to complicate our military operations in the future. I think on the broader point that Dan made, one of the problems is, yes, we can give countries vaccines, but we're not being generous about allowing them to manufacture the vaccine at home, giving them the intellectual property or the technology so that they can do it at home. And again, the number of vaccines the United States and the West has committed so far is a drop in the bucket.
Okay, I want to take a listen to some news from our northern neighbor.
Thank you all. You are sending us back to work with a clear mandate to get Canada through this pandemic and to the brighter days ahead. And my friends, that's exactly what we are ready to do.
That, of course, is Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who managed to keep his job this week, but failed to secure a governing majority. Dan, do you agree with the Prime Minister's analysis that he has a clear mandate in the North?
No. You know, he has a better mandate than anyone else, which is why he's going to be leading the government. But, you know, this is, he's paying the wages of a gamble that he took. And in some ways, this actually evokes what Theresa May did in the UK a couple of years ago, where they were riding high in the polls for a brief time. And of course, in a parliamentary system, you can, you know, call for snap elections at that moment with the idea that presumably means you can govern without a coalition, which Trudeau then did, and then shockingly enough, did not quite do as well as expected. Although, again, he will be running the government. So it's not the worst outcome for Trudeau, but it's not the best either.
So what does that mean for the U.S., this idea that Trudeau won, but is yet again the head of a minority government?
I think the way that probably most Americans and even the Biden administration might view this is whether or not this is a cautionary tale for elections in the United States. So, for example, the Populist Party in Canada did a great job of drawing votes away from conservatives, and therefore it was viewed as potentially an indication that maybe U.S.-style populism is spreading to Canada. And so if you're the Biden administration, you obviously have to be worried about how this will play in the midterms and in 2024. In terms of practical relations with Canada, I don't think it really changes all that much. Again, you're going to see the same players running the government in Ottawa. Justin Trudeau and Joe Biden have, I believe, reasonably good relations. Although it should be noted that the Australia sub-deal didn't just annoy the French, it also left Canada out in the cold. And I think there were a lot of raised eyebrows about that. So much like the U.S. relations with other allies, the sort of macro picture is one of relative stability, particularly after the Trump years, but nonetheless, plenty of irritations beneath the surface.
Robin, I wonder if there is a U.S. ally that the Biden administration is managing, maybe gardening really well, like one where in his time leading our nation that we've seen a strengthening of that ally relationship.
Biden faces many challenges in finding stable allies because there are so many other places that are going through the Canada experience. You have elections in Germany in October, and while Angela Merkel is still popular, her party is not necessarily going to win again. And there's no clear indication of who might win, and it may take weeks to form some kind of coalition government. For 16 years, Angela Merkel was the anchor of Europe and a steady interlocutor with Washington, and Germany may not be able to play that position for a little while. France goes through presidential elections in April, and of course, Macron was deeply embarrassed by the crisis with the United States over the nuclear submarine deal. He was excluded from it and humiliated, so that may have an impact on him. We're heading for a period of kind of instability among many of our Western allies, even when people we know Biden knows well has good relationships with are reelected. This may be their last round. And of course, we don't know in our country whether Biden will be one term or two. Will we go back to a Trumpian style politician again? So I think there, on the leadership question, there are lots of variables out there that are going to make finding solutions to the biggest existential problems of our time ever more difficult.
Dan, let's, in these sort of final moments, give me a little bit of a look forward. It maybe offer me the most positive and most negative potential outcomes here. I mean, maybe not most negative. But when I hear Robin talk about the very real challenges facing us and the complicated nature of addressing them, I'm wondering if we should be bracing for a period of global crisis, or even though things are looking kind of rough, we're actually moving into a space where we should expect sort of more global cooperation. What's your assessment?
Okay. So the positive story would be to say that the Biden administration's approach toward these threats is accurately assessed, and also that their patience with respect to China and Russia, which is to say that they recognize that those countries are not necessarily going to agree with the United States, but they do believe that there's value in a working relationship with both of those great powers, eventually pays off as China and Russia realize that they need to cooperate more on the pandemic and they need to cooperate more on climate change. And you could argue that there's a trajectory whereby the world, having suffered through some serious years of pandemic, genuinely recognizes that the biggest threats to the world are no longer coming from states, but rather coming from sort of environmental reactions to the growth of the human population. And therefore, you actually do see some concerted action. I don't know how likely that is, but that is one positive trajectory. The negative trajectory, and bear in mind, Melissa, that I teach a course every year entitled The End of the World. So I'm pretty imaginative on this, is that, in fact, we don't really ever escape the pandemic, that we operate in a world where, you know, COVID becomes endemic. You see much higher mortality rates. This causes countries to turn inward. And here's a really scary part of this, which is as much as dealing with climate change or trying to mitigate the effects of climate change is a global story, one in which you need to have global cooperation, adapting to climate change is really a story of countries. You can exclude others when you adapt to climate change. You can, you know, sort of harden your infrastructure. You can try to take steps to prevent the worst of sort of extreme weather. And this is an instance in which the developed world will be much better off than the developing world. And this includes China, I would add, simply because the developed world is richer and also has more infrastructure that it can use to combat. And so if you have an instance in which the United States and Europe decide to turn inward, global cooperation is going to break down. Life might be reasonably okay in these countries, but it will get worse and worse everywhere else. And you will then start seeing a migrant crisis that makes previous migrant crises look like a pittance.
Robin Wright is a columnist at The New Yorker and Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow. And Daniel Dresner is a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Edward from Miami, Florida. Pretty much the only con that I found was with the you know, with leaving Afghanistan. I mean, I did want, you know, the soldiers to get back, but not abruptly. I wish that the perhaps NATO or the UN, whoever, that they would have kept, you know, some presence there, you know, and not make it depending on the U.S., you know, that they have to stay there. You know what I mean? That way, you know, they can offer at least some extended help to them. That's so far my only issue with the president right now.
I just miss the America First policies of the previous administration. Our enemies no longer fear us, and our allies are no longer trusting us. We need to go back to peace through strength. This is Carol from Norwood.
As a black person who voted for Biden, I was outraged to see what was happening down in Texas with Haitian refugees. My name is Ben Allen, and I'm calling from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Hi, this is Connie from Mercer Island. I just wanted to say I'm really happy with how Joe Biden has improved the relationship with our allies, particularly with Europe, although we have a couple hiccups right now. But I think the cons is obviously the Afghanistan pullout. I don't think that went as well as perhaps it could have. But I'm not convinced any administration could have done that any better.
My name is Doris Lynn. I live in Freehold, New Jersey. I'm so disappointed in how the Biden administration is treating Haitian asylum seekers. I'm a Democrat. I voted for Biden. I campaigned for Biden. I went door to door asking people to vote for Biden, and I am so disappointed.
I think Biden is doing an admirable job trying to navigate very difficult situations. I think anyone getting us out of Afghanistan would have had terrible problems with such a difficult and complicated situation. I understand that Macron is not pleased with Biden about the arrangement with the submarines, but, you know, in negotiations, sometimes you have to step on people's toes. In terms of the border and the Haitian situation, I just feel it was timing, and this is an opportunity for him to show some real leadership, which would mean to humanely treat those people who are trying desperately to escape from Haiti. This is Keith from Dallas.
Hi, this is Sarah from Dallas. I'm very disappointed and disheartened by President Biden's U.S. foreign policy. I don't see how Democrats win in the midterms with these cruel and regressive policies.
I was so happy that Biden won the election and very satisfied with his coherent, decisive, and dynamic foreign policy drive during his first 2 to 3 months. The last few months have left me worried that we could have another Trump presidency. The withdrawal from Afghanistan may have been statistically successful, but there was no realistic management of expectations or narrative while ongoing. The submarine contract fiasco is an embarrassment. Immigrants are pouring over our borders from all over and ending up in horrendous circumstances. Where is the leadership?
Hi, this is Mary from Philadelphia. After Trump, it's a blessed relief to have someone who values NATO, values democracy, and all of the institutions that support it.
There are 4 questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. On Wednesday, the U.S. Senior Special Envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, resigned. He made his resignation letter public, in part through social media, and it reads, in part, quote, "I will not be associated with the U.S. inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees and illegal immigrants to Haiti, a country where American officials are confined to secure compounds because of the danger posed by armed gangs in control of daily life. Our policy approach to Haiti remains deeply flawed, and my recommendations have been ignored and dismissed when not edited to project a narrative different from my own." Now, Foote's resignation comes just days after photos and videos captured officers of the Border Patrol mounted on horseback chasing and abusing Haitian migrants. Those border agents have been temporarily suspended. But the White House continued to stand by their enforcement of Title 42. Worth noting, that policy has in fact been blocked by a federal court and ordered to halt by the end of the month. Here's Jen Psaki.
It's also important for people to understand what our process and our immigration process is and what the steps are that are taken. We are still under Title 42 because we are in a global pandemic.
As of Thursday, according to the Department of Homeland Security, the number of Haitians in Del Rio, Texas is down from roughly 15,000 on September 18th to about 7,000. As deportations continue, some have turned back to Mexico and others have been moved to another area for processing. Patrick Gaspard is president and CEO of the Center for American Progress, and he traveled to the border this week. He joins me now. Patrick, welcome.
Good day, Melissa. Thank you for having me on in this troubling moment.
Let's just start with your experiences. What did you see at the border?
It's one of the most difficult things that I've ever experienced. Melissa, I think you know that I am Haitian American, and it was difficult to be there and not appreciate that it's only an accident of birth, an accident of geography that put me on one side of the fence while I looked at thousands of Haitians, mostly women with young children, who were living in squalor, who were in incredibly vulnerable condition. I saw one woman who was very pregnant, going into contractions while her husband called for help. Thousands of others literally sitting in mud, having their meals in mud, trying to care for their children underneath this bridge. I want to applaud the volunteers who've come down to lend humanitarian relief, particularly from the World Central Kitchen. And it's important to commend the residents of the very small town of Del Rio who have done their level best to lend some kind of support as well. But given that we live in the wealthiest country in the history of humanity, It was very, very difficult to see the circumstances under which people who are seeking asylum from natural disaster, from political violence and economic dislocation are being held at our border.
Are you surprised to find conditions like this at our southern border fairly well into the Biden administration?
I was compelled to go to the border because, most Americans, I was shocked and disturbed by the images of mistreatment and cruelty towards those migrants and asylum seekers that we all saw. We all saw the images. It's important that the Department of Homeland Security and the White House announced yesterday that they're discontinuing the use of horses in that manner. They've suspended the agents who were involved in that violation, but that's what compelled me to go to the border. We should all be appalled at that. And yes, I continue to be disturbed, irrespective of the party affiliation of office holders, that we would upend our own norms and treat migrants and asylum seekers in this fashion. I'll remind you, Melissa, that this administration is operating right now in violation of an order from a federal judge who told them that they can no longer continue to use and abuse Title 42 as a way of forcefully expelling asylum seekers.
So I'm thinking here of Senator Ted Cruz. When he heard that, you know, that the Border Patrol would no longer be using horses, he kind of, you know, joked about it in a tweet in which he, you know, showed, you know, presumably like a cat on a unicorn, saying this is what Border Patrol would now be like. And I thought to myself, you know, The notion that our partisanship, our internal domestic politics, so affects our ability to read like a humanitarian crisis. I wonder, you know, again, particularly given your leadership of CAP, of the Center for American Progress, how do we get to a place where even across partisan lines, we can see a humanitarian crisis as humanitarian, not an opportunity to score partisan points?
Yeah, you know, the senator's behavior is on this and on border issues has been nothing short of irresponsible. And he has stoked some of the worst instincts of our fellow Americans. I'll tell you, Melissa, I appreciate how difficult all of this is. You know that in my past life, I was a senior official in the Obama administration. I've served overseas as an ambassador on behalf of the United States, and I know that there are complexities here, and there's been a challenge to work in a multilateral way with our partners in Latin America to lift up a humane border administration. That being said, there was a time when there used to be a more broad bipartisan consensus on how we receive migrants and asylum seekers. And it used to be possible to develop some real consensus between Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and all Americans. I still appreciate in my experiences, and again, with my experiences with Americans at the border in Del Rio yesterday, there is empathy, there is solidarity, there is an ability to see the individual at the border and not a mob. I think the folks in Del Rio that I conversed with and engaged with are a good deal more thoughtful than the senator has been. So I continue to be encouraged and hopeful. And I will say that in this moment when folks like me and many others, I accompanied Reverend Al Sharpton to the border yesterday. I will say that in as we've raised dissent, as we've agreed with Ambassador Foote in his characterization of this policy, we've been able to engage openly with Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas and other White House officials who've acknowledged that the images that we all saw were reprehensible. And who have taken some action. We continue to call on them to cease and desist from these forced expulsions, to go back to humanitarian adjudication of asylum claims. And Melissa, it's hugely important that we have this conversation in the broader context of U.S. foreign policy in Haiti, where regrettably, across multiple administrations, there continues to be support for the worst autocrats who have thwarted democratic progress and civil society activity. We need a change in that policy because that, along with natural disasters, has caused all of this dislocation.
I want to take up this issue of natural and man-made or political disasters. And if you could reflect for us a bit on sort of that long and quite honestly bipartisan set of practices of the U.S. Public policy and foreign policy towards Haiti. For folks who haven't followed it, say, since the Clinton administration, just give us some of those key moments.
It is a long and tortured history, Melissa, that goes back to the founding of Haitian independence when Haiti became the first self-liberated Black republic and would not receive the recognition from the U.S. right up through the 20th century, where my parents were forced into an exile of sorts from Haiti because of political violence by actors who were completely supported by the United States. My earliest political memories, Melissa, are of being a child demonstrated in front of Lafayette Park in the White House or in front of Dag Hammarskjöld when successive U.S. presidents put their arms around Haitian dictators and called them friends of democracy who were thwarting communism in the region, even while they looked away at disturbing human rights violations. More recently, our government, along with others in the region and internationally, continued to support the presidency of Jovenel Moïse, who was tragically assassinated some months ago, despite the fact that he suspended the Senate, supported violent gangs in the streets who inflicted political violence on his opponents, and despite the fact that he was operating out of his constitutionally limited term. The U.S., following the earthquake in 2010, insisted on elections and in Haiti, irrespective of the fact that the vast majority of the population could not participate after nearly 300,000 deaths, millions dislocated from their homes, and all institutions in the government completely just taken apart by the earthquake. And since then, there continues to be an insistence more on stability than on democratic norms. I will tell you, Melissa, that I'm heartened and encouraged by a bold, courageous civil society process that's come together in Haiti in the last many months with over 350,000 organizations, labor unions, women's groups, even former gang leaders who've come together to say that we need Haitian solutions to these problems. We'll build our own resilience and sustainability, and we just need the international community to recognize the need to turn away from autocrats and elites who have denied economic opportunity to the vast majority of the country. I hope that in this moment of transition, the Biden administration will lean into human rights and democracy in Haiti and appreciate that outcomes in Haiti have a direct relationship to the difficulties that we're now experiencing at our borders. These things are interrelated and must be addressed in a holistic fashion.
Now, Patrick, you served as ambassador to another nation where there are more than a few challenging historical points around questions of justice and America's discourse on one hand and our actual foreign policy on another, and that's South Africa. And as the special envoy to Haiti resigned, which is just unusual that, you know, that a lead diplomat in that way would feel that need to speak out in that way, I'm wondering what lessons you take from your hard work in diplomacy around South Africa in this case as well.
I did have the privilege to serve as U.S. ambassador to South Africa, a country that I first went to during the tail end of apartheid, right after Nelson Mandela had been released from 30 years of confinement. It was a time of great euphoria and incredible hope, and it was extraordinary to be able to serve as ambassador after being a young demonstrator against apartheid. I will tell you that one thing I learned in my time in that remarkable republic is that democracy making is hard work. Mm-hmm. It is a full contact sport. And I think that South Africans should be rightly proud of the progress that they've made in only 30 years of inclusive democracy in that country. And when we consider our own journey here in the U.S., which was fraught with tension, only resolved through civil war, one can appreciate the challenges that they're undergoing now and also recognize that that journey requires the real thoughtful support of allies and other nations in partnership. The same is true now for the furtive journey that Haiti is making towards inclusive democracy as well.
You speak, and this is, you know, such a core part, I remember, of my own sort of political awakening of what it meant to be a Black American from our wide diasporic experiences, but protesting apartheid and pressuring our government to do right in particular ways by Black South Africans. As you look now at the crisis at our border, are there specific ways that the broad diasporic Black community in the U.S., yes, the Haitian American community, but also our broader Black community, what are some of the ways we can be working to bring pressure, to bring insight, to bring information that supports this growing civil society, Haitian solutions for Haitian challenges?
Melissa, I'm always really inspired by your voice on air because you have the ability to widen the aperture. Thank you for bringing the diaspora into this. That is absolutely critical here. I think that diaspora engagement and advocacy has enabled us to make meaningful progress already with the Biden-Harris administration on these issues and on the abuses that we're seeing at the border. And it's critical to have continued advocacy. One appreciates the charity that one has seen from the diasporic community with grants to frontline organizations. But it's terribly important to communicate to members of Congress, to the Congressional Black Caucus that's led in this, to your Senate leadership, that we're all shocked and disturbed by the mistreatment that we've seen. There's a need to end these deportation flights that are in violation of our own constitutional norms, as communicated by a federal judge. We have to ensure humane treatment at the borders and access to real asylum systems in this country. And in the very first instance, we must have some ability to lift up the best of ourselves and ensure that we end dangerous, unsanitary, and unsustainable conditions at our borders by providing adequate shelter, food, and water.
Food, water, and shelter for 10,000 women and children hardly seems like hard work for a nation as wealthy as ours. Patrick Gaspard, President and CEO of the Center for American Progress, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Melissa.
Okay, people, it's been good having you with us this week. And remember, we always want your take on any topic. So email us a voice memo or recording to takeawaycallers@gmail.com or just call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Now, if you are liking what you're hearing, make sure that you actually subscribe to the podcast version of The Takeaway and maybe ask some of your friends to do so as well, okay? We could definitely use the love. So give us a rating while you're there. Big props to the team making this all work every week. We've got the amazing Vince Fairchild, board opping and sound engineering and sound designing as well. Jay Cowett is our director and editor, hanging out in the control room in NYC. He even gave me a Zoom tour of the building this week. Jackie Martin is our line producer, slicing and dicing it all for you. Shanta Covington made magic happen every day this week and gave us so many good stories, including a late night conversation about the Border Patrol with former patrol officer Jen Budd. Meg Dalton is a radio wizard. She produced, among others, our segments on kids' vaccines and police reform, along with the incredible Deborah Goldstein, who has hit the ground running with us already on so many big stories. Katarina Barton was our ace on Ethiopia coverage this week, plus a big part of our redistricting conversation. But listen, so many stories. All of these folks throw in on so many ideas and pitches and productions. They are warriors and guardians. Our man, Ethan Oberman, acting senior producer, leading the whole team through every single week. He's an audio juggernaut. Zach Bynum is our digital media editor, and he has been killing it on the ones and the twos of our website. And David Gable is our angel voice executive assistant, who brings us joy on a daily basis. Lee Hill, REP, announced this week that he's trucking on up to Boston later in the month to head a big old newsroom with our friends at GBH. We love him dearly, and we hope he gets a big sip of champagne this weekend. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.